All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. And welcome to the SLS Cast. Yes, episode 3. The trilogy closes. Just kidding.
Then we have to move on to do the prequel.
Yeah, this is, yes. So we'll do our dress rehearsal that we recorded, and I'll put that one up. No, we're not going to do that because that was terrible. Let's see.
It wasn't too bad. It wasn't all bad. It wasn't like when we first started like 3 months ago bad.
This is true. You know, sitting around trying to go, hey, you want to do a movie podcast? All right. So how you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you. And yourself?
Not bad. We have got tons of content to get to today, so we're going to jump right in. We kind of like the flow of movie news, so we're going to go. We have obviously been discussing our movie news so that we can bring you a nice report. So, Tim, what do you got for us, sir?
Okay, I have quite a few things. I'll just, you know, just go right down the list. Ricky Gervais of The Office fame, who started off the BBC show, I guess it's been like 10 years, oh, maybe more than 10 years, yeah, probably about 10 years or so ago, with him and Stephen Merchant, and then afterwards he did a few, you know, stand-up comedy shows, and he worked on the show Extras, and now he's...
You didn't mention the first show, by the way. You just kind of went, yeah, it's been like 10 years ago, so what was the first show?
The Office.
Okay, just making sure. I mean, yeah, I knew you knew, but you didn't say, so, you know, there might be people out there who don't know who Ricky Gervais is, so.
The Office.
There you go.
And then the Extras, and now he's been in movies and hosted the Golden Globes a few times.
Probably never again.
But he was pretty good. But the first trailer for his new BBC Two sitcom called Life's Too Short.
Even the title is just ridiculously awesome, because who's it starring?
Warwick Davis.
That is exactly right.
Himself. And the show is basically about this, I guess, what is like an alternative, you know, life of Warwick Davis, where he's just constantly like getting, you know, all these Willow jokes and Leprechaun and Harry Potter jokes thrown at him. And he's just playing like this big asshole to all these people, really stuck up. And obviously, apparently, that's not who he actually is. It's just for the you know, the comedic value and whatnot. But yeah, no, this little bitty trailer for just an introduction to it is up, and I think the show is going to be terrific. Already, Johnny Depp and Jerry Seinfeld have been confirmed to be some of the guest stars.
Heck yeah, Sting. Steve Carell as well. So,
oh really? Oh cool.
Yeah. So I mean, it's definitely going to be great. I like the idea of kind of combining. It's kind of interesting because he's kind of Gervais. He's definitely not a one-trick pony. Obviously, he has done so much, but I like the idea of, you know, if Extras and The Office got together and had a bastard child that turned evil, I think that's what Life's Too Short is going to be like. And I for one, am completely looking forward to it.
It'll be great. I mean, there's going to be a lot of Willow jokes. I mean, I grew up with my dad just, you know, coming up to me saying, you know, like, Willow!
Yeah, my stepdad enjoyed Willow. He liked that. I never really took Warwick Davis away from that. Even though the movie was supposed to be kind of about him, I always took Val Kilmer away from it.
And oh, yeah?
Yeah, I was like Val Kilmer's side of it. And my favorite line is when they have the baby, okay, and Val Kilmer has this root or whatever that he's kind of chewing on. He gives it to the baby, and the baby's kind of chewing on it. And, you know, Willow comes by, and he's all, you know, what are you doing? He's like, what? It's great, this, you know, this bark is awesome. It'll put hair on your chest. It's a baby girl. She doesn't need hair on her chest. So, you know, I don't know. these are the things I think about. All right, so what else do you have?
Ron Howard is slated to direct, like, it seems, 5 million.
I was just about to say, good lord, is there anything the man won't touch?
I mean, if it wasn't the new Da Vinci Code movie, The Last Symbol or Lost Symbol or whatever it was the Dark Tower series, and I read a week or so ago that he was supposed to be directing an IndyCar movie called Rush. Well, now Ron Howard is set to direct a version of Spy vs. Spy, which I believe derived from Mad Magazine.
Yes, back in 1960s, actually. It was Antonio Braja's created property. First appeared in 1961 as part of a Mad Magazine number 60.
Wow. Yeah, so I mean, it's supposed to be like a very, you know, action-y visual film. So, I mean, it could be... obviously it has to be CG. I mean, I cannot see it being a live action.
Well, okay. Actually, with what he was able to pull off in Grinch Who Stole Christmas, I believe in Ron Howard. I think he could do a live action version of this.
I don't know too much about Spy versus Spy, but like, are the other characters?
There are no other characters.
Do they look like?
It's just Spy versus Spy.
Well, then how are they going to pull that off?
What? It's Tom and Jerry. It's the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote. It's Elmer
exactly,
Fudd
but how,
and
yeah.
Bugs Bunny. Did you need,
but if they're making
need
a Bugs
any
Bunny
other characters to make that work?
Well, in every movie they came out with, yes. Space Jam,
but that's
Tom and
not
Jerry
what
movie
that was about, though.
Correct.
What they did was they took the world of their antics and created a plot for them. Here, you can have two guys with funny-looking long noses, for all we know, who could just be twins that decide to hate each other for some reason, just actively trying to destroy one another with wanton destruction for an hour and a half. I think it could work. And if there's someone who could pull it off, it's Ron Howard. So, I don't know. I think it could work. I really do. I think that, you know, if as long as the plot itself is inventive and the gags they use to try and do one another in are kept fresh and inventive throughout, sure you could do it with just two people.
I mean,
Face-Off?
Don't get me wrong.
What,
I think
Face-Off,
it would be a...
there you go. Sure, there were a couple of minor characters in there, the wife, the daughter, or whatever, but essentially it was two guys trying to kill each other the entire movie. That's all it was.
Correct. Well, that's true. I mean, no, I'm not saying that they have to bring in other story components. It's just, if you have these two characters with, you know, they're not human, I don't think. They look bird-like. And if you put it into our world with human beings, and that would be, I mean, it's like the Smurfs. I mean, they could have easily have made a Smurf movie taken place in the Smurf village, but they didn't. Because Hollywood is ridiculous like that sometimes. So, I mean, if they can pull it off, I think it would be terrific if, you know, if it's just two characters throughout the entire movie, you know, doing what they do best, which is trying to kill each other, that I think that would be hysterical.
Moving along.
Watchmen's Alec C., T-S-E, will write The Crow remake, the movie that I am reviewing today. Found out they're going to be doing a remake of it. I don't understand why the hell you want to remake.
Because Hollywood truly has run out of ideas. I am finding it is very interesting. I never thought I would say this, but I am finding that it is easier to go outside of America now to actually look at foreign films to go find original ideas. They're not afraid to explore original ideas in other markets for whatever reason. I think it's kind of a telling sign of just, and not to get too political or anything, so sorry if this isn't your bag. I think it's just kind of a telling sign of how America has turned into a bunch of sheeple. When you go to the movie theater and to go watch your movies this week or whatever, go in there, watch, just listen carefully and you'll hear it. You'll just hear it out throughout the whole thing. You know, they're cattle. They're like sheep. They will do whatever you tell them and go wherever you say as long as you keep them fat and happy. And I don't want to hear the, oh, but they're trying to introduce it to a new generation of filmgoers who didn't get to see it 17 years ago. Well, I don't care. You know what we did when I wanted to see a movie that hadn't been made in 17 years because it was made 17 years ago and I was a kid? I watched that movie. You see, I went and watched, like we recommended The Quiet Man last week. I watched The Quiet Man when I was a kid. That movie hadn't been made, you know, that movie was, whatever, from the 50s. You know, I watched it the very first time I ever watched it was in the 80s. Oh, no. Oh, they didn't have to remake it for me to watch it. And they didn't have to remake it for me to think that it was a good movie.
Did you watch it on LaserDisc?
No, I watched it on freaking VHS. That's what I watched it on, by golly.
By gosh darn it.
Dang it, Alden Melvin!
So one of the three freaking Snow White movies that's coming out, one of them called Snow White and the Huntsman, recruited three new, almost said hobbits, but dwarfs. Okay, so these, the three announcements for three of the dwarves, I think are perfect. Okay, Eddie Izzard, Bob Hoskins, and Toby Jones. In other news, a new trailer. I don't know if you are familiar with the great David Cronenberg, director.
Give me some of his work. I don't know his name offhand.
He wrote the movie The Fly.
Okay, so are we talking about the Jeff Goldblum one or the original one?
The Jeff Goldblum one. He directed Scanners, Videodrome, The Dead Zone. He also directed The Fly. He directed M.
Wow.
Butterfly, Crash from 1996, Existence, A History of Violence, Eastern Promises.
The last two were okay. I wasn't a big fan of Eastern Promises, really, but History of Violence was pretty good. It was an interesting story. So, okay, well, very good. All right, now that I am refreshed on his name by his work, which is extensive and good, what do you got?
Yeah, well, he's coming out with a new movie called A Dangerous Method about the relationship of Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung. But yeah, but the trailer looks awesome. It's very intense. It's just going to be I think it's going to be an awesome film, knowing David Cronenberg, filled with sex and drama and all good things like that, and really terrific performances. It looks like it'll be. But yeah, I'll be posting that on the website as well. Another trailer that came out is for the new Puss in Boots. And also in new trailer news, there's a new trailer up for that Antonio Banderas movie called The Skin I Live In. Remember
yeah,
me telling
dude,
you about
that? Okay, that movie is... people were, like, totally grossed out by that movie and, like, way turned off at a con and everything whenever they showed it.
Really? I did not read about that. And then another trailer. It's the Muppets movie. The new Muppet movie trailer. So that's something for you folks to enjoy. And second to last for me, Warren Beatty is trying to get Baldwin, Benning, Shia LaBeouf, Jack Nicholson for a new Howard Hughes project, which I guess it'll go a little bit more in depth than the Aviator. So I would have loved to have seen a Howard Hughes movie post him.
But that's what made the Aviator so good, was that that's all anybody knows about him, for what little they know about him,
yeah,
is that he was some crazy ass recluse who was some billionaire dude, and that's all they get.
I agree.
And so the Aviator actually showed where he came from and what he did and how innovative he actually was. And yet also showed the madness and where it came from, and basically just stopped where it needed to stop because it led you to what he turned into.
Yeah, well, the movie was so good that I really wanted to, you know, I would love for Martin Scorsese to finish, you know, like the story of Howard Hughes. I think that would be kind of interesting. And last but not least for moi, Jamie Foxx is confirmed for Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained. Apparently Will Smith didn't jump on the bandwagon for this this film. So I'm pretty excited about
cool.
that.
Well, let's see here. Jump into a few things. We will also be providing the first images from The Hobbit. So we'll have a link for that as well. Something else that I thought was pretty interesting, that's kind of on a weird, kind of a loop, so to speak. They have They have a list. It's provided by 24/7 Wall Street. It's a finance section of Yahoo. And according to Douglas A. McIntyre, there are 10 brands that will disappear in 2012. Now, are they related necessarily to entertainment? Kind of, sort of. Most of them are not, but there were two in particular that struck me as entertainment-worthy. The first one was number one on this list, which was Sony Pictures. Sony, apparently, they bought back in 1989 for $3.4 billion. They bought out Columbia TriStar. So they were trying to rebrand it, save it, salvage it, do whatever. Unfortunately, it has kind of gone down the tank. So their fiscal year ends in March. The current period, however, their revenue for this group has dropped 15% to $7.2 billion, and the operating income fell off by 10% to $466 million. So, last year, Sony as a whole was in trouble anyway, because last year they lost $3.1 billion on revenue of $86.5 billion. So, they are looking to do everything that they can. The CEO, Howard Stringer, is under pressure to do something with the increase to, basically just do something to increase Sony's shares. And the only valuable asset that he can dump is Columbia.
Oh. That's a
Sony
bummer.
Entertainment will disappear with the sale of its assets. The other one that I thought was interesting was MySpace, which is number 8 on this list. We will provide a link to this if you would like to see the entire list, but just in the interest of time. MySpace, you could do a whatever happened to it. Because literally, whatever happened to it? Nobody understands. Nobody really understands what happened.
Facebook?
But see, MySpace came out after Facebook. And MySpace completely dominated the world from Facebook.
Well, I think it was because Facebook was supposed to be more for college people, and so they got all the college, older kiddos into Facebook. And then once the word got around about Facebook, and I guess the ban on only having it limited to college people went up, people went ahead and went to Facebook because they thought it was for the the more distinguished of people to be on.
I don't know. But maybe. It's interesting because News Corp bought out MySpace back in 2005 for $580 million. And they thought that was pretty much a steal. Then MySpace went on to hold the top spot from mid-2006 to mid-2008. Then Facebook overtook it. So now Facebook has 700 million members worldwide and recently passed Yahoo as the largest website for display advertising based on revenue. So, unfortunately, wow. News Corp was able to get an exclusive advertising deal at the time worth $900 million shortly after it bought the property, but that's the best it ever did. So, if nothing else, they at least did make some money. Maybe they lost all the money they've made since then. I don't know. But they now hold that its audience is currently estimated to be less than 20 million visitors in the U.S.
Really?
So, wow. The question, why did MySpace fall so far behind Facebook? And the answer, no one knows for certain.
I don't know, listeners.
You tell us exactly
what you think.
You let us know what happened. It may be that Facebook had more attractive features for people who wanted to share their identities online. It may have been that it appealed to a younger audience, which tends to spend more time online. It doesn't matter, because News Corp announced in February that it would sell MySpace. There were no serious bids. Rumors surfaced recently, however, that a buyer may take the website for $100 million. The brand is worth little. If anything, the buyer would likely kill the name and fold the subscriber base into another brand. So, yeah. News Corp has hinted, though, that it will close MySpace if it does not find a buyer. Yeah.
Wow.
So, tip of the hat to Douglas A. McIntyre at 24/7 Wall Street.
That's got to be a record of some sort. I mean, it has to be some sort of record.
I don't know. A couple other things real quick there is that we'll also provide a link so that you can see a short interview with John Lasseter on Cars 2, as well as a couple of little Easter eggs and some other information there. I am a big Jason Statham fan, and he's got a new movie coming out in September called Killer Elite that has him and Clive Owen and Robert De Niro. So we'll have a link for that so that you can see the trailer.
Cool.
All right, and so that is the end of the news, and we will now jump into Three Squared. Yes, Three Squared it is. So let's see. For those of you who are playing at home, your Three Squared assignment was to come up with a producer that you enjoyed and give us three examples of his or her work. So
not only do they have to listen to us jabber for an hour, we also have to give them homework?
Yes!
Oh, that sucks.
Well, it's not that we have to give them homework. They get to play along with us. Do you see?
Oh,
I
guess that's good.
You know, they are allowed to participate. It's not just us telling them stuff. We want to make it interactive. That's why we give them links to click and, you know, Three Squared segments to play with. So.
Okay, well, that works out.
Which is going really well, because, you know, so far we have had two reviews, one 5-star review from the website and one 5-star review from iTunes. So people are listening. Three Squared. What was it?
Okay, Three Squared producers. Who wants to kick it off? Should I kick it off? I'll kick it off. What the heck? I'll take the liberty in kicking off Three Squared. The producer I chose was somebody who made a name for himself in the 80s and in the early 90s. Born in 1943, unfortunately died in 1996. He was probably one of the many people that made the deal with the devil and, you know, had a lot of success and then had a, you know, contract was up, had to go.
Well,
anyway,
least it wasn't the Oh God, You Devil contract, because that would have just been 7 years.
But yeah, so his name is Don Simpson. He made actually the first... I don't think Flashdance was a huge movie. It was definitely a cult film. I don't think it did too well in the movie theater. I know it got shitty reviews.
It is a cultural. It is a pop culture film.
Yeah, yeah. And he also did Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2, Top Gun, Days of Thunder, the very funny The Ref, Bad Boys, Crimson Tide, Dangerous Minds, and The Rock. Now, I have to pick three films, only three films for this guy. I would probably skip Flashdance and head directly to Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2. But for the sake of, I don't know, just for the sake of it, I'm just going to be putting Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2 together. So that'll be one. I'll hit Top Gun for number 2, and I'll make The Rock as my number 3 with Nick Cage and Sean Connery. And the reason why I pick those is because they are movies that hold up today as entertaining, funny, romantic, looking at Top Gun, sad, I suppose, and The Rock being a great action movie. All right, Co-Chief, you take it away with
Square. All right. So, I chose someone who has had a ridiculously prolific career. Now, I didn't set out to do so, but I just was like, man, you know, I always see movies and it was literally the first name that popped into my head as a producer was Joel Silver. And I was like, man, let me go and check and see what this guy's done, because I know he's done a few things that I've liked or whatever, and I can think of, this man's done, like, 40-something movies that are, like, ridiculous. The man is responsible for 48 Hours. He's responsible for Lethal Weapon, Predator, Die Hard franchise, Matrix franchise. Say what you will about the last two, but he's, you know, Matrix was still amazing. Romeo Must Die, Exit Wounds, Cradle to the Grave, V for Vendetta, most recently Sherlock Holmes, Book of Eli. I mean, you know, just ridiculous. Just tons and tons of movies that this guy has done. And even the ones that are kind of out there, so to speak, you know, like Hudson Hawk, which I'm sorry, I just love that movie. or Tales from the Crypt, Demon Knight, you know, a Bordello of Blood. I mean, he's, you know, sure, some, you know, and they haven't all been winners, I grant you, you know. But even the ones that haven't been winners, like the Warriors, it's the, you know, cult classic there. So, man, it's really hard to pick just three movies from this guy. But I would probably have to... Okay, I'm going to cheat a little bit, too. I'm gonna put the Die Hards 1 and 2 together.
Okay.
Okay, that's kind of a deluxe package there. I am then going to follow that with Romeo Must Die.
Oh, really?
Yes. This is just a fabulous movie. Because... obviously, the man's done the Lethal Weapon stuff, and he did Commando, you know, all that. So, I mean, he's got all this. So, I mean, I think that the diehards can expertly cover that side of it. And then he kind of shifted into this with the Matrix kind of thing, where he kind of did more martial artsy, actiony, kind of funny-ish, but still kind of serious gang kind of movies. And yeah. Romeo Must Die, you know, that was then, that was, you know, like Exit Wounds, Cradle to the Grave, that kind of stuff. So I'm gonna throw Romeo Must Die. That was definitely the best. And so that kind of gives you that aspect of his life. And then kind of into the more recent era, even I guess by recent, within the last 5-6 years, I'm gonna throw in V for Vendetta.
Awesome movie. Awesome.
And because that kind of, you know, again, because, you know, now that kind of gives the Sherlock Holmes feel and, you know, all that kind of stuff with what he's been doing more recently. So I would say the Die Hards 1 and 2, Romeo Must Die, and V for Vendetta. All right, so new movies. Yes, we're going to start with new movies. First new movie, we'll just cover. I'm just going to knock them all out in a row, if that's okay.
Okay. All right. That's cool.
Kung Fu Panda 2. Went and saw that with my daughter. In the interest of full disclosure, we did have to leave because she pulled the "I'm 4 and I'm going to get upset for no reason" kind of a thing, which is really weird because she does not generally do that. Well, because she'll be 4 next month, but whatever. So we had to leave probably with about 15 minutes of the movie left. However, thoroughly enjoyed everything I saw in that movie. It's a very simple plot, but it's a sequel, and B, it's a kids movie, so, you know, we're not looking for much here. But the gags were pretty good. Jack Black was in good form, and the action sequences, you could actually see that there had been a legitimate progression since the last movie of his character in terms of his ability and stuff, and yet that he still had things to learn. And cool. That was one badass peacock, I gotta say. He was, you know, being a peacock, he was pretty badass. So, I'm sure that at the end of the movie he saves the day. I'm gonna guess here. But I really liked it. I thought it was good. The next movie I saw was Super 8. Super 8, the trailer is not misleading, but because of the scope of the movie, it's just not able to give everything that the movie really is. It is not able to showcase the depth of that movie.
And I think that's good, though.
I think it's bad, because consequently, I did not want to see this movie.
It didn't look
very good. It's not a misleading movie. It's, I will, other than to say, it is really about the kids. It really follows the story of the kids, which is slightly not what it looks like from the trailer.
Well, see, and I think that was an interesting way to maybe even get more people into the movie.
I guess. As an adult and a dad and a movie watcher and whatever, I would have seen it even if I knew what it was about.
Yeah.
Even if I had known going in that it was all about the kids. So, whatever. But that being said, the trailer not being able to showcase the full depth of the movie hindered my wanting to see the movie. However, went and saw it, fantastic. Fantastic movie, well written, well directed, you know. If ever there was a combination made in movie heaven, it is J.J. Abrams and Steven Spielberg. Go see that movie if you haven't seen it yet. Third movie I went and saw. Oh, go ahead, sorry. Did you want to say anything?
Do we want to talk about Super 8 a little bit more? Or?
I was just going to let you jump in with your side, because we got six movies we've got to cover. So I was just trying to bam, bam, bam.
Okay, well, I'll jump into Super 8. Okay, well, yeah, I saw Super 8. Actually, I went to the midnight showing, a couple weeks ago. So there's a large variety of people in the movie theater, and what I like with movies like that is seeing or getting the feel of everybody's reaction to it. And by God, I was expecting going to that movie and seeing a damn like an alien invasion film in a vein of maybe like a 50s, kind of like a classic alien type of feel to it. But what I got out of it was so much more. It had so much of that emotional investment into the film, that kind of in the vein of E.T. or even Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It definitely has the nostalgia kick factor to it that was provided by Spielberg in the 70s and 80s. And you're right. I mean, it's very much all about the kids. And is that a bad thing? Not at all.
No, definitely not.
Yeah, because it was fun. It was exciting. I remember being that age, or being a young kid, and going out with my dad's old Sony VHS video camera and trying to make a movie, trying to do that, trying to make it as professional as I could. And even when I go back and look at them now, it's kind of like I can still see the creativity I had as a kid and the emotional investment I put into making a film back then still kind of, shines through now to where I can look back at it and, kind of enjoy it. So I could totally relate with these kids and what they were trying to do with making a zombie film with a, old Super 8 camera. So it was just totally cool. I had one problem with the movie. I'm going to give up a big, big, big spoiler alert right here. Which I guess is a good thing, since it's 2 weeks after the movie was over, so maybe a lot of people have had a chance to go see it. But the big spoiler alert is that you never see the alien, actually see the alien, until the last maybe 10 minutes of the movie? 15 minutes?
Not true.
Not true.
I saw it. And if anybody out there is a Easter egg movie file, then here's your big spoiler. You get to see it in the gas station scene when the sheriff gets knocked off.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that, because that's what I thought too. I get to see it till the end. And when the gas station attendant comes out and it's the puddle, and he looks in the puddle of gas, and you see him looking down, and the shot is the puddle of gas mirroring the car with the dude looking at it, you can see the alien staring right at him. Full
really?
On face right there. And I was like, hey, he kind of looks like the Zool and Ghoul or whatever from Ghostbusters. The little things that Sigourney Weaver and Rick Moranis turned into.
And
I was like, hey, look at that. And you never see it again, but you do get to see it the one time.
Oh, I have to go see that. But okay, so here's my problem. It's minor. It could even be just like a personal thing. But reading up on it, there were people that were actually really, that actually bothered them about it. But before I say it again, I love the movie. I'm actually gonna take my grandfather to go see it because I think he's gonna love it. But. Other than, I guess, at one time, you really don't get a full-fledged, actual look at the entire monster until the very, very, very last portion of the film, during the climax. And the whole thing about the alien is that the alien takes these people, takes them into, its hideout area, and kind of like a, I guess, a snake or whatnot, or not a snake, a spider, puts them in a cocoon. Well, whenever the alien touches these people, the people, I guess, get an eye, like, see into the alien's mind, or gets a feel of what the alien is.
Link.
Yeah, like a psychic link. The main kid is able to see, like, the what the alien is going through. Like, all he's trying to do is trying to go home. Where at the beginning of the movie, the alien was captured, you know, or before the even movie begins, the alien is captured, put on a train, the train crashes, it's let loose into this town. However, it was hard for me. I really wanted to have the emotional depth and feel for the alien itself, but I didn't get that because the alien was so damn terrifying, which there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, that could be a good little lesson, I suppose. But, you know, the alien was so terrifying, and it was so, I mean, just what it, I mean, like, you know, kill people, take them, you know, just what it did was so bad, I suppose, that it was hard for me to really feel for the alien, which I think was, actually, I know that is what J.J. Abrams was trying to convey in the film. It was they were trying to make this emotional attachment with the audience in the alien. Now, what I did buy was the emotional attachment with the... Well, I kind of bought the emotional attachment between the alien and the main boy. But there wasn't like that one defying moment that really, you know, that I was able to accept to go, okay, well, you know, I feel for the alien. I understand that, okay, well, this is, you know, the alien is just wanting to get off the planet. You know, he's just a scared alien, if that makes sense.
Okay. It seems that your observations are a little misguided. And here's why. Two reasons. One, as we stated before, the movie was about the kids, not the alien. So I'm not here to have an emotional attachment or to understand the point of view of the alien. Okay? It's about the kids, and you become emotionally invested in the kids. Hang on. Secondly, they do provide the, maybe not understanding or liking, but they do fully provide the condoning of the alien's behavior by explaining the alien was just trying to go home and was poked and prodded and tortured and tested until basically he hated everybody. All humans became game for death because of what the Air Force had done to him. What emotional thing are you trying to get out of it?
The alien is going off and
he is now doing whatever it takes, or he, or whatever, it is now doing everything it takes to get out.
Exactly.
Take no prisoners, just get home. End of story.
Exactly.
So
But to me, that's the thing, is that all this shit is going down, and he goes to the alien's area, where the alien keeps its captives, the water tower area, and he finds the girl. And at that moment, that's when he finds out that, okay, well, this is what's going on with the alien.
No, they knew before. They knew that, like, half an hour before when they were covering the research. When they went and invaded the dungeon on the school premises and they were watching the footage. They saw the whole thing. And then they played the tape, and it's the professor guy.
Oh, the professor.
And he's sitting there telling them the whole story. He told them exactly. And that's how he figured out that there was an underground thing. He's subterranean, and he remembers seeing the dirt fly up inside the building at the graveyard.
Yeah. Well, I still don't. I mean, I don't know.
It's okay. If you didn't like it, if you would have liked to see more, that's fine. I thought they explained it. They covered it.
I love the movie. I very much enjoyed the film. I am never that person to say something needs a more explanation because in saying that, I think it's like, well, you're just stupid for, you know, you're just stupid for wanting more explanation, not really looking into it. But there was just something
about... I didn't
mean
to say that. Is that what you're taking from that?
No. I know that's what I say to people.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. All right. I was like, I did not mean to intimate. Like, I wasn't trying to...
No. I wasn't saying that at all.
All right.
You're good. But it's just that, you know, the connection between... Because, I mean, it's like the alien did all this stuff, and it was just... It's just hard for me to be like, you know, get that feeling for the alien. And... I mean, I know that's what JJ, that's what they were going for.
What do you mean?
Because
you mean, you, in your opinion, they were going for the audience needed to care about this alien somehow?
Yes.
I completely disagree. The whole story, what they wanted you to care about was the kids. That's it. The alien is the catalyst. The alien is the means by which the kids have this adventure.
Well, no, I do agree with that.
So then,
I mean,
you keep coming back to that J.J. Abrams wanted people to care about the alien. I don't think
because
so.
Because I'm going off an interview from J.J. Abrams.
Well, then you probably should have prefaced that, because...
I did. I said that, like, 10 minutes ago.
No, you didn't!
I did, too!
Okay, I kept hearing you say that that's what J.J. Abrams wanted. I did not ever hear you say that it was from an interview.
That's what I heard from an interview. I mean, I mean, I'm going to go back and find the interview, because it could be possible that, you know, I did not mishear it.
That's right.
I believe you.
If that's the case, then yeah, he totally failed, because in that regard, he totally failed. But it almost doesn't matter, because the movie is amazing because of the story of the kids. Who cares about the alien? That's, oh, poor alien mistreated by the government, because that's not cliche. The government doesn't ever just take over aliens, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I'm quite frankly a little disappointed that he attempted to do anything in that regard. As a plot device to help further the cause of the kids, to help them figure out what's going on so that they can... you know, so that they can complete their adventure and actually have the movie happen, I'm totally fine with it. But to get me to care about the... No, not even a little bit. Did not even care about the alien at all. The alien was trying to get home. Excellent. Alright, good. Alien gets to go home. Cool. did not care about the alien. Was not upset even a little bit. Because quite frankly, the alien was somehow stupid enough to crash land and, despite all this massive power, get contained in 1950s government for 20 years, is able to be contained by the government, deserves everything he got. You're supposed to be smarter than us. Get out of the concrete cell. That's all I'm saying. You are able to make car engines, microwaves, the entirety of a town magnetically float to a water tower, but you can't break out of a concrete bunker.
Actually, here's something else.
Not buying. Sorry. Don't care about you. I don't care because you're too stupid. So let me go to the kids who I care about.
And I'm going to read this little paragraph from Roger Ebert's review of Super 8. And this is something of the... kind of the special effects realm of the film that he kind of had a slight problem with. And I mean, Roger Ebert gave the movie 3.5 out of 4 stars, and so this is just like a little blip of a concern. During the first hour of Super 8, I was elated by how good it was. It was like seeing a lost early Spielberg classic. Then something started to slip. The key relationship of Alice and her troubled father, Lewis, went through an obituary. An arbitrary U-turn. Joe's own father seemed to sway with the requirements of the plot. The presentation of the threat was done with obscure and unconvincing special effects. We want the human stories and the danger to mesh perfectly, and they seemed to slip past one another.
Okay.
And I think he has a point on that. I remember reading that right after I saw the movie.
I agree to a degree with the daughter father relationship. I really agree with the boy's dad. That what with his evaluation of, you know, of the dad's relationship with his son. Somewhat agree with the evaluation of the daughter and her dad. Completely disagree with it in terms of the special effects. I thought the special effects were solid enough that you could believe what you were seeing for today with just enough of nostalgia factor built in so that you could believe it was happening in 1979. And it, for me, it was the subtleties of the light reflection shots in the wide angle shots and stuff which happened a lot. Like if you look at Close Encounters, if you look at E.T., a lot of the angling of the light and the wide angle shots, when you would see the little blue line cut across the top of the screen and stuff like that, very reminiscent. I mean, you know, and they didn't have to do it that way. I don't know. I like the special effects. I thought the special effects were good. Maybe I'm just not as cool as Roger Ebert. All right. So, last week, you'll remember, I was rallying against Green Lantern and how much it sucked. I will bump it up on my just now made-up scale of how good a movie is on a scale from terrible to wow, just wow. That's my new scale there. I'm going to bump it up from a terrible to a meh.
That was the text you sent me.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, meh. So, it had the potential to be so good. And what they really should have called this movie, okay, Green Lantern, we should have come out before Thor. Essentially, it tries to do the same thing that Thor did in terms of getting the audience an understanding of what happened to create the universe with which Thor lives, and same with Green Lantern. Only they didn't do anywhere near as slick of a job as Thor did. And then on top of that, they kept trying to bounce back and forth between the Green Lantern CGI world and the Earth world. And in doing so, they kept trying to run two simultaneous plots that were supposed to interact, but didn't really at all. And you have one bad guy who kind of turns into two bad guys that's really still just one bad guy with 6,300 Green Lanterns, even though there's only supposed to be one because that's what the movie's about. And they kind of don't like the new Green Lantern dude, and he's got to prove to the universe why the human's the best in the world again. They got too much stuff going on. And they're trying to get the movie to take itself seriously, but still be Iron Man kind of clever and stuff, and that fails more often than it works. It does work in a few places. And there's just, it has no flow, it's got no structure, it wanders around too much. Ryan Reynolds doesn't get as many of the Ryan Reynolds-y kind of lines that he needed in the character like this, that he should have gotten. The highlight of this movie, Peter Sarsgaard, yeah. He actually plays the Earthbound villain. He's basically Parallax. Parallax is the bad guy of the movie. Though his Earthbound form takes place of Hector, a scientist, son of a senator. And this character is played by Peter Sarsgaard. He steals this movie, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. He is awesome. I loved watching him. Every scene he was in was great.
I like the actor. He's pretty cool.
So the movie's worth watching for him.
All right.
But, yeah, so there you go. And I watched it in 2D, and I wasn't sorry I watched it in 2D. Yeah.
Was it at least better than Spider-Man 3? It has to be better than Spider-Man 3.
Yes. Not okay. By much, but yes. Okay, so we had to watch From Paris with Love. You had to watch The Crow, and I had to watch Black Death. Let's start with From Paris with Love.
Okay.
What'd you think?
Okay, well, From Paris with Love. Okay, what would be a good way to explain what the movie is about? It's set in Paris, and it's about this one guy played by John Rhys-Meyers.
I think he is a legitimate government operative placed as the attaché for the secretary, for the ambassador to France. That being said, whatever government post however he got the government post, through the CIA or through the Secret Service or whatever, he is simultaneously trying to become a secret agent. And so as part of his job with the being the attaché or whatever, is trying to get into that, they have him just doing little odd jobs and stuff.
And so he gets paired off with John Travolta's kooky-ass character.
Yes. This is his basically his tryout for the big show. If he can successfully, quote, drive his partner around.
Yeah. And we'll leave it at that, because I think the fun of the movie is knowing that it starts off as a kind of like a the story, at least. It's like, oh, about cocaine dealing and whatnot. And then it kind of moves in another direction, which I think is also kind of a part of the fun of the movie. And I guess there's like a slight twist as you go along. So yada, 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 yada. But besides that, I thought the movie was entertaining. I mean, it's labeled as John Travolta's, I think, most fun movie since Pulp Fiction, I suppose. And I can see how people think that, but I'm not sure if... Well, I can't really... Off the top of my head, I can't think of another fun
Broken
movie.
Arrow.
Broken Arrow is fun. Even Face Off is fun. Yeah. But it was a very entertaining movie. I mean, I laughed my ass off with John Travolta's little antics and his little sayings and the stuff he would do, like...
Wax on,
you know,
wax off.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just even the
complete irony is that they're Chinese. I just love that. I'm sorry. they don't ever hit on that in that little discussion. I'll say it, so someone else, another thing to watch about the movie.
Yeah, yeah, and it's just a pretty good movie, and it's written by Luc Besson, who made Leon the Professional, and most recently that a lot of people went and saw for some reason, Taken, with Liam Neeson, which it's not a bad movie, but I thought it was overrated. Yeah, but From Paris with Love is just a fun movie. I mean, the only problem I had with it are the earlier action scenes in the movie when John Travolta is fighting people. You never see him complete a fight move because of the quick edit. So you can tell that, you know, it was a stunt guy, I suppose, that, you know, jumped in and did all the fighting, because you never see his face. And that's what really kind of ticks me off with the Luc Besson movies. I kind of want to see the completion of a fight to really get the really, like, oh man, that's a badass fight scene.
Okay.
You know, there just has to have that completion. So that is the only real critique I have of the film. The only negative, you know, stuff about it. But other than that, I enjoyed it.
Well, I have to agree. I went into this film with zero expectation and came away from this movie with, it's an excellent popcorn action flick. It takes about 12 minutes, 12, 13 minutes to get going. The setup took a little too long, I think. But that aside, I did not have so much problem with the action flick, because with it being Luc Besson, that I've come to expect that from his movies, so I'm okay with it. Didn't bother me any there. One thing that did bother me was when there is a kind of an interactive love. What do we say his name was? Jason Rhys-Meyers?
John Rhys-Meyers.
John Rhys-Meyers, thank you. He's supposed to have, he's got a fiance. Whenever they weave the love plot in like that, I felt it was taking itself a little too seriously and really brought the action to a dead stop, and then they would just make it explode into action again. And they didn't need to do that. They could have just left it with... They could have kept the love side of it in dialogue while the action was going and as they were moving. And they did it a little bit, and when they were doing that, I was fine with it, but when they actually started to focus on it, it was bleh. So, that part, so only when it took itself a little too seriously did I have any problem with it. Other than that, I thought it was a great movie.
It did have a pretty cool little car chase scene at the end.
Yes.
I really enjoyed it. That was a lot of fun.
So, you know, I would recommend it. Again, action aficionados only, I would totally recommend this movie. So,
yeah.
Awesome. Okay. Next down, we have Black Death. Someone made a post on their Facebook page saying that there's probably going to be some fighting going on about this. Well, while I can say that it will not come to blows, there will be some fighting about this. So,
love the movie.
I did not like
it. I watched it again last night, and I really like it.
I do not hate this movie. Okay. First of all, what I find this movie to be ridiculously misleading. Okay? And that is my... That leads into every single problem that I have with this movie. Okay? Is that what this movie is about is not what this movie is about. Does that make sense?
Explain.
Okay. First of all, Sean Bean.
Okay? All right.
I like him. I think he's a good actor. I enjoy him as a villain. It was nice to finally see him play a good guy. He so rarely does it. So, okay, good. You literally have to wait like 14 minutes. And the movie is an hour and 40 minutes long, including the credits on both ends. So you gotta wait 14 and a half minutes before you even see it.
Well, that shouldn't make any difference.
But the whole thing is, it's not about him, is it?
No, it's not.
That's right. So why are you pasting his name all over the damn thing? But the actor that you're supposed to, that the movie is actually about, who is actually a nice actor, and I like him anyway.
Well, it's for marketing to get people actually to watch it.
But it doesn't matter, because he's actually Eddie Redmayne. He's actually a good actor, and he's actually done stuff that people would have seen him in, especially even in an American audience. That would have seen him really recently, because he did Pillars of the Earth on Stars. So, not necessary. So the movie says it's got Sean Bean, it says it's about Sean Bean, and it's not.
It doesn't say that's about Sean Bean.
Dude, they completely imply that it is all Sean Bean. Okay? Look at every single movie poster. Look at everything that goes across over the top of it. And it's him. Okay? So I wasn't, you know. And then they describe it as historical horror. It's not horror at all. There is no horror in this movie whatsoever. Okay? So, misleading there. Second thing that it's misleading is that it's like, oh, well, it's not about Sean Bean fighting the Black Death. It's now about Eddie Redmayne's character struggling over whether or not he needs to go be with his girlfriend, whether or not that's going to interfere with his plans with God. Okay? Because he's in a monastery. He's a novice.
Yeah. Well, that's at the beginning of the film, yeah.
Oh, yeah, because it has nothing to do with the middle or the end of the movie either, right?
I know, but that's what I like about it.
Misleading. Okay?
That's what I like. Exactly. That's the point of it.
That doesn't make a movie good. That does not make a movie. I mean, being intentionally misled so that you're never sure of what's going on, you know, and they constantly build up to nothing. They literally constantly build up to nothing. Again, misleading. They build up with the beginning, they change it on you by telling, oh, it's a love story, or oh, now this kid's not sure what he's supposed to do. So they lead up, and what do they lead up to? Nothing. He's just got to...
Okay.
He's going to be leading a group of people around. Okay, lead up, find out. Oh, it's not really what it's meant to be. It's not... Oh, they're not really going to just lead him to... He's not really just leading the village. Oh, now there's a necromancer. But then nothing. Okay, so let's camp for a while. All right, great. So now he's decided he's going to go check on his girlfriend. Lead up. The girlfriend's missing. Looks like she's dead. And then they get attacked, and then nothing. They just kind of wander through a swamp for a while. Now Sean Bean's mad at him because in the fight with the thieves in the forest, they lose one of them. Sean Bean. They get to the forest. They look around. Everybody's finding the lead up to nothing. Oh, sure, guys, come and stay for a little while. It's fine. And then, well, okay, well, we're, you know, thank you for letting us stay in the hospitality. Let's investigate. Lead up. Let's get on nothing. It's just a look. It's an empty church. Yep. Looks, there's a necromancer here. Look out. Okay. And then they go and they lead up. Nothing. They're just going. He gets and meets the.
Well, it's not like leading. I mean, they're not trying to like lead up.
Yes,
lead
they
up,
are.
Lead
they intentionally shoot the shots. He puts the shots in the order so that you think something is about to happen when nothing happens. You know.
Well, are you talking about like not, something pops up? Or like, you know, like an actual whore?
No, not even an actual whore. Like, they show Karis Van Houten's character. She plays the actual necromancer. They show her, like, readying all the herbs and making her potions or whatever. And they look like, you know... And it's just a poultice that she applies to Eddie Redmayne's stab wound. You know, they have him... As they were... Going through the village, they have her, they show her making the stuff. Like there's something about to happen. Or like, this is important. But you need to pay attention to this. And it's nothing. I didn't hate it. It was well acted. No, don't get me wrong. It was well acted. Okay, the technical aspects of the film. Sean Bean does a good job. Eddie Redmayne does a good job in terms of acting. Especially Eddie Redmayne's confliction and how he plays that. Because he wants to do the right thing. And all he's trying to do is just understand the hand that life has dealt him. So I get that. The pacing of the movie constantly led to nowhere. I did not like the direction. The writing was
Do you think the pacing had something to do that you didn't watch it all the way through? As in, you stopped a couple times?
No. I only stopped one time, and that was because I was watching so late. I went to bed. And when I thought that I had only had 20 minutes left, no, I actually had like half the movie. I had stopped at a really good point.
All right, well, onto my review of it. Okay, so I went and saw this at a movie theater, and just to verify what I'm saying, to make sure that, you know, the reasons why I like the movie, you know, were still there watching it last night. And whenever I first watched the movie, I dug the opening, like it drew me in, and the entire movie reminded me of a just like a gothic tale. And I am very interested in the bubonic plague. I love the history. I've studied it. I looked into it. And I'm also into the supernatural look into the idea. Also, like the whole, you know, the whole witchcraft aspect. I just think it's a very interesting story. And this is something that they never really made a film about. At least as of recently, they have. And I can't really think of another movie about, you know, the bubonic plague they made.
Does it have to be necessarily the bubonic plague, or can it just be anything involving witchcraft in the church?
Well, no. I mean, I thought the idea of the bubonic plague was a terrific backdrop. And whenever I saw the movie, it sucked me in at the beginning. And probably about maybe 6 minutes into it, the whole shaky camera thing really got to me. And that was the one thing that bothered me for some reason in the movie theater, was just the shaky camera.
I don't like
shaky. And yeah, I hate shaky camera.
It's a cheap way to make someone scared, in my opinion. It just adds, it's trying to make you confused and try to understand what's going on, and it's really hard because the camera's shaking, and quite frankly, it just blows the piss out of you. So.
Yeah, and the movie had great lines, I thought, especially with Andy Neiman, who was Dallywag, and...
That the best, for me, the best line of the movie was, "I'm ugly and I'm a Christian. They don't mix, and that's not a good mix or whatever. So piss off." That was great.
Yeah, yeah. And the line where the chick goes up, she goes, "Okay, well, I will give me a minute and I will tend to your wounds." And he turns around and says, "Well, I'll tend to your wound."
Yeah.
But I recommend it. I highly recommend it. It does have. Certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, or it is certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. I'll point that out as well.
So, next movie then, final movie, Crow.
I really dug the film. I really like The Crow. It's directed by the great Alex Proyas, who directed the tremendous film Dark City. Did you ever see Dark City?
Is that the one with Kiefer Sutherland?
Yes.
Yes, I did. Very good movie.
Great film. He also directed A Knowing with Nick Cage, which I actually really enjoyed. He also did iRobot. He did the movie called Garage Days, which is actually, it's coming in the mail. I'm going to watch that this weekend. And basically, The Crow is about a man who was murdered. Him and his girlfriend was murdered one evening. He was a rock and roll musician. And basically, he comes back from the dead, guided by this crow, to avenge his and his fiance's murder. And despite the violence in the film, there's a lot of violence in the film, and it's definitely not a feel-good film at all, because there's just this undertone of sadness and this undertone of dark, you know, even, yeah, yeah, just this undertone of sadness and dark throughout the entire film. But it's just a thrilling film. I mean, there's entertaining action. There are entertaining performances by all the, you know, even the main bad guy in the goons, you know, just like the bad guys actually kill and even rape his fiance. It's just ridiculous how something so dark and grim can be such an entertaining film. And not only just entertaining, but it's a good film.
There are still uplifting elements.
There are, and
to the movie. And
exactly.
That is wise, because there's still redemption.
Yeah, and they could do the flashbacks with Brandon Lee's character, who he is the crow, but he's not the crow, but his character's name is Eric Draven. And when they do flashbacks to him and his girlfriend, or him and his fiance, it's just very sweet, very, very sweet. And I thought they just really encaptured, just like kind of like also the rock and roll feeling from like the early mid 90s as well. You know, just like the music they use from the time, and even the actors they use at the time were, you know, you can see them. Actually, most of the actors, you can see them in a lot of films. Even Ernie Hudson, you know, from Ghostbusters and whatnot. You know, it's just a very well put together movie, and the look of the film is awesome as well. I mean, if whoever's listening has at least seen Dark City, very much like Dark City. At least the look of the buildings and the art and direction of the film. So I highly recommend it. I don't recommend it to, say, my grandfather, you know. But, you know, just people who appreciate films in general, I think would really, really, really enjoy this film.
I'm very glad that you liked this one, especially because coming off of Johnny Dangerously, you didn't enjoy that one as much.
Which, looking back on it, I think I was a little too harsh on Johnny Dangerously. I will say that.
Oh, well, that's nice. Yeah. But still, you know, you still, even, you know, looking back on it, maybe judge a little judge. I was really hoping that I wouldn't give you I was really hoping to bounce back. I really wanted to get you something that you would like. So it seems like we went the reverse, because you weren't as big a fan of Johnny Dangerously as I was of HUD, and now we've kind of gone the other way around.
Yeah.
This time, maybe we'll fix it for the next, you know.
And something tells me we will, because we actually picked some pretty good films for.
I think so. I think when we get there, yeah. But yes, I totally agree. Everything that you found that you liked on it, I liked it. But there was one element that we touched on it just barely a minute ago. That it truly is that in a movie so dark and so seemingly hopeless and so focused on vengeance and justice, violently dispatched, mind you. You know, what is redeeming about this movie? Why should you see it other than just, you know, art noir and, you know, and that kind of thing? It's because through it all, there's the trace of redemption. The little girl, you know, the young girl who finds hope in the story, and her mother who, you know, in a very moving scene when Brandon Lee grabs her arm because she's a junkie. This girl's mother is a junkie, and he grabs her, and all of a sudden you see the heroin and pus just start oozing out of her arm, because he's, you know, he's like, you know, you have a daughter that needs you, and then you see her actually try.
Yeah.
You know, that it's those glimpses of redemption. Ernie Hudson's character, you know, who doesn't stop looking for the bad guys. And basically, you know, gets who was a detective, and he's basically a patrolman, you know? You have these elements of redemption that's what makes this movie, I think, so good. That's what gives it its longevity, is that regardless of how dark it is, you know, kind of like a, you know, I made light of it, but, you know, it can't rain all the time. You know?
Yeah.
So...
Oh, and it's filled with great quotes as well. So many. So many good quotes.
I mean, and even though the joke is old, I love when he walks in. Stop me if you've heard this one. So Jesus walks into a hotel, hands the innkeeper 3 nails, and says, can you put me up for the night? I mean...
You know, and I love the line he tells the main bad guy. I think his name was Top Dollar. You know, right when, you know, he's really taking him out, he says, like, I have something to give you.
Yeah.
I don't want it anymore. 30 hours of pain all at once, all for you.
Yeah.
Such a good line. Such a damn good line. And it's all throughout. I mean, even his, like, little quirky stuff, like, when he's about to, like, you know, kill somebody, you know, kill one of the gang members, you know, he just... I love it. And just, like, him... experiencing himself coming back to life, like whenever he gets shot in the hand and there's a bullet hole through his hand, and at first when he gets shot he kind of freaks out, and then he looks in his hand and the camera's looking at the eye through the hand, and he just starts laughing, like, you know, just manically, maniacally or whatever, and, you know, just kind of just starting to enjoy it, you know. And like you said, it's just that, like, little also bits of humor in the film as well that really bring light to it. And I can't picture anybody else doing it than Brandon Lee.
Yeah,
so it's a shame that, you know, they're wanting to do a remake of it.
Let's see. So we have two more things we need to cover. We'll do our classic movie recommendation. Do you have a classic movie recommendation, sir? No. There you go. Now my movie is called The Thin Man.
Oh, yeah. And they're also remaking those movies, too.
See? Do you see what I mean? This is so ridiculous, because these movies don't even need to be remade. They are still amazing movies even today. And The Thin Man is the one that starts it all. It was a series of movies. I want to say, like, 6 or 7? Could be wrong on that, but I mean, there were definitely a series of movies here, and it's the Nick and Nora Charles series. Nick is played by William Powell, and Nora is played by Marilyn Loy. They're basically stylish and kind of like independently wealthy sleuthing spouses, and they, you know. I don't know, they basically, this one is investigating the disappearance of a wealthy inventor. But, I mean, it's just like they just, one-liners, just constantly going back at, you know. And they're very smart, very quick-witted, well-written. For the 1935 Academy Awards, it was actually nominated for Best Writing, Best Picture, Best Actor, and Best Director. So, this movie is great. You got to see it.
Good choice, yeah. It'll be better than the Johnny Depp remake that, you know, they're planning on doing.
That leads us to, last but not least, The Twilight Zone. All right, so this now, it's the third episode in the series for season 3. It's called Mr. Denton on Doomsday. And so far, of, you know, we only have 3 to go off of at this point. I'm of the opinion this is the weakest of the 3 that I've seen so far.
Agreed.
Okay. It's basically a it's Western theme. It's a town drunk, and he used to be a good fighter, a gunslinger, and then they reveal he kind of lost his nerve, turned to drink, and he, you know, basically gets made fun of. The coolest part about this whole thing was Martin Landau is actually the bad guy, so to speak, in this movie, in this particular episode. And so it was fun to see a young, vibrant Martin Landau at work. So that was fun. And then, basically, fate kind of intervenes. And through the intervention of fate, Mr. Denton, basically, the town drunk, regains his nerve and his composure, and comes back to prominence as a gunslinger. And he gets, and he has to face off against another younger gunslinger. And spoiler alert, the twist is that when fate intervened for Mr. Denton, he intervened in the exact same manner, which was, here, take this tonic, and for 10 seconds, 8 or 10 seconds after you take this tonic, you'll be the fastest, most accurate shot. And the young gunslinger who challenges him, fate has also given him the same thing. So they end up shooting each other. They shoot each other's guns. Because they're both so fast. And so Mr. Denton's like, yeah, but we're both alive. And that's what's really important. And then, you know, happiness ensues. So, it was a little too happy-go-lucky, a little too much kitsch for me. Pacing was a little off. You know, nice little morality tale, I guess. What did you think?
I agree. It was still enjoyable. It just didn't have, coming off of two really strong, even deep episodes, mm-hmm. it just didn't have that, you know, just when it's over, it's like, yeah, it's like, okay.
Yeah, it was a little too simple, I think. Yeah. So, worth watching, just so you know, if you're following along with the series, just so you can say that you can watch it. But definitely of the three so far, the weakest. And so we will be carrying on to watch the next one. And I guess there you go. So, anything else you want to add? Because I believe that's going to end it for us.
We need to recommend the movies still.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I always forget that. The movies we're going to be watching next week. The movie we're watching together is a foreign film called I Saw the Devil. It's a very recent movie. It's 2010, and it's pretty much in the vein of The Crow. It's a guy going after the people who killed his fiance. So... we can't get away from that, but it seems very interesting. So I'm looking forward to it quite a bit. That's the one we're watching together. I have recommended To Sir with Love, which is a Sidney Poitier, and I kind of like to think of it as a Sidney Poitier vehicle, 1966 version of Dangerous Minds. The movie that I get to watch, because I always confuse this movie with Help, is A Hard Day's Night. So I have not seen it, even though I saw Help, so I'll get to watch that one. And I think we just might have a trifecta here. I think we might have some movies that all of us, that both of us will like.
Yeah, no, I think it'll be great.
All right, well then I think that does it, man. Anything else that you need to add?
No, I don't think so. Thanks to everybody who's been helping out with the getting the website together, especially the lovely lady that will be doing our nifty little web, our web design.
Yes, you know, yes, we'll as be well. Thanking yes, Brandy at Kega Creative Group. So that's who's going to be helping us with our logo. So we're really excited with that. We're still in the process of getting that stuff made. Also, quick shout out to Jeremy Page, my good friend, who fixed our episode 1 so that they're actual click here links instead of please try to copy and paste these long things. So there is that for you. And thank you to Cries of Solace. The music that you listen to is courtesy of them, and they are available on myspace.com, maybe for not much longer, /Cries of Solace. Also on Facebook, /Cries of Solace. And they have a website coming soon, so hopefully you'll be able to go directly to criesofsolace.com. Because their music is really good, and man, I still can't wait for everybody else to get to hear their music. Being in with the band, I got to hear their latest single ahead of time, and wow, it is, man, it's by far and away the best song that they've got so far. So there's cool. That. Thank you again to our 5-star reviewers, to the listeners that we have had, and our iTunes fans. So remember, you can always rate and subscribe at iTunes and at slscast.com. You can follow us on Twitter at theslscast, and you can email us at theslscast@gmail.com. So thank you, thank you, thank you, and we will see you next episode.
Alrighty, take care, guys.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.